My job has always been to exaggerate reality. And so, when I did The World According to Ronald Reagan, I took him and some of the simple, more simplistic ideas he had and just exaggerated him. With Trump, I wouldn't have to do anything.
That's David Horsey, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. If you are a fan of David Horsey's work, you have found the right place on the dial. The entire show today will be dedicated to a recent conversation I had with David. As many of you know, David Horsey was an editorial cartoonist with the Seattle PI. Then he moved on to the LA Times between 2011 to 2018. He is now back in Seattle and an editorial cartoonist with the Seattle Times. He is a graduate of the University of Washington, and as a freshman, he became the editorial cartoonist for the student newspaper, The Daily. His first job was a reporter for the then Bellevue Journal-American before moving on to the Seattle PI. I will start my interview with something that may surprise you about David Horsey. It certainly did me. Also, is Donald Trump an easy target to write about and do editorial cartoons about, or does he actually make his job more challenging? His answer to this question surprised me as well. What are his opinions about the country today and the media? All this and much, much more today. My name is Paul Casey, your host and producer of Voices of Experience. If you have any suggestions for topics, any comments on today's show, you can reach me at 206-459-5536. That's 206-459-5536. Back with my interview with David Horsey in just a moment.
You're listening to Voices of Experience with Paul Casey. Visit voicesofexperience.com and take a 5-minute self-employment quiz. That's voicesofexperience.com. The higher you score on the quiz, the higher your prospects for success. One more time, visit voicesofexperience.com. All one word.
I had the opportunity to visit with David Horsey, Pulitzer Prize-winning David Horsey, actually two Pulitzer Prizes, for his cartoons that he's been doing for many, many years. I've actually been observing his great work since the 1980s. After a stint with the LA Times, he is back in Seattle, and I visited with him at the Seattle Times offices. A couple of years ago, David Horsey came over to Washington State University and was our guest speaker for the Edward R. Murrow Symposium. I want to start out the interview with something I learned about him that I was rather surprised to find out about him. And I'm pretty sure you will be too. And that is, he is a closet cowboy. So my first question was, when did this all start?
It probably started when I was growing up as a kid watching cowboy shows on TV endlessly, Cheyenne and Maverick and Ponderosa, whatever that was.
Bonanza.
That was it.
Ponderosa.
Yeah, right. That's where they live, Ponderosa. And just that, sort of playing as a kid, it just had this the myth of the cowboy was always in my head. And over the years, every once in a while on a vacation somewhere, I'd ride a horse. And I ended up going to a guest ranch in Montana with a couple of friends. And they were pretty serious about riding. And actually preceding that, you're going to get the long version here.
Please.
Yeah. Preceding that, I was in L.A. Visiting some friends who, this is before I was working there, quite a few years before, but my friend was taking writing lessons, so I went with her just on one of her lessons, and at the end of it, the instructor said, you're pretty good. And I said, I am. I just did what you told me. And she said, well, most people don't do that. So I thought, maybe I don't have a very stellar athletic career. I'm not the most coordinated person. So I suddenly discovered this sort of physical activity that I could do. So then I went to this guest ranch where they were real serious about riding and teaching riding. And that was fun. But I had this myth in my head of, the I wanted to really be out there just riding on my own or with some other guys and not in a line, not with an instructor. And anyway, a friend of mine who worked at MSNBC.com at that time ran into her at the Ellensburg Rodeo, and she was with some friends who were serious riders, and this guy said, well, you ought to come to Montana with us, because we got a group that goes over there every year and we help this rancher. I got into that, and it's this rancher who, with this 29,000 acre ranch in eastern Montana, just started inviting people to
come. Is that Connie?
Connie, yeah. And so I've gone there year after year, and actually it reached a point where I actually knew what the heck I was doing. could go out and move cattle and not fall off my horse most of the time. And I guess what was great about it is, besides fulfilling the fantasy, well, it made the fantasy into something else. I realized this is real life. People actually do this. People I don't know, people are totally different from everybody in Seattle in their daily lives. And this is really an interesting thing to put myself in a very different world and to, get a little competency in it. And it's so utterly different from what I do day after day, sitting around drawing cartoons, that was part of the appeal too. I didn't, when you're riding a horse and trying to move some cattle from here to there, you don't think about anything else but that job. And it was exhausting, but kind of liberating.
You were said something in the book that he wrote or something about it. It's like what he said to you was, when you're out in this big sky, literally country, that only a fool feels bigger than he should.
Right.
You put that in there, and I thought that was really interesting. Yeah. Did you have that feeling too out there?
Oh, definitely. It really kind of, and I think part of it, in my job, certainly in Seattle, I've gained this notoriety, and in some circles, it's like a big deal to meet David Horsey. And out there, I was just another guy who could barely, who was definitely not the best at doing the things we were doing. And I kind of liked that. It was just me, whoever, it was divorced from an identity associated with this career I've had.
And well, that's what's interesting. That's why it caught my eye when you told me about that a few years ago. I would have not thought this would be a David Horsey type of thing. All right, well, I'm going to switch subjects now.
All right.
Is that okay? And that is, I want to start something, the map that you did in the 1980s with Reagan in America. And I think we were like quiche freaks up here in the Northwest. And
tree huggers.
And ecology, and we cared about water, and we're crazy.
Yeah.
And you've done some of those following that around the world. I don't know if I've seen any recent ones, but I'm going to ask you, if you were to visualize doing that today, what would it look like?
It's the world according to Donald Trump. I mean, I've had that thought because, part of the reason I did it with Reagan was, at the time, his critics said he had, his view of the world was overly simplistic and kind of had all these narratives going on in his head. But Trump makes him look like a genius. So if I were to do Trump, I wouldn't have to make stuff up. And that's been the strange thing in this current era. My job has always been to exaggerate reality. And so, when I did The World According to Ronald Reagan, I took him and some of the simple, more simplistic ideas he had and just exaggerated him. With Trump, I wouldn't have to do anything. If I drew, his vision of China or Russia or Saudi Arabia and sort of his worshipful view of these various dictators and tyrants around the world, I wouldn't have to really make anything up. It would just be using his tweets as a reference, probably, and the way he talks about you know, some parts of America, California is, you know, sort of the foreign land and enemy territory. I mean, it would be very, I don't know why I haven't done that one yet, because it would be simple
to do.
Well,
you know, what, yeah, I'm just, maybe that's your block a little bit, because it's all out there. I mean, Reagan, you were able to just simplify and break it down easy. Yeah. But when I talked about Trump with some of the individuals, he's the most transparent president we've ever had.
Yeah.
And Kennedy. It's all out there. There's no, like, that's what I'm saying, this Mueller report or whatever you're going to, what are we going to find, this smoking gun? There's no smoking gun.
Yeah.
He said everything. You know, he's done. He said, call me, I fired him.
He's just shooting the gun.
Right. He's doing it all the time. So how, it's a technique that is just stunningly effective. I just can't believe how he continues to get away with it. But less is more is less. He keeps firing and firing. Yeah. And I don't see any melting of his base, no matter what he does. And that's what's the sort of, I don't know how many times I've said during the campaign, oh, this is it. He's done now. He's crossed that line now. We don't have to worry about Donald Trump anymore, especially with the McCain thing. I just like, okay, that's it. He's done.
Yeah. But you see? No, that was just the beginning.
Right.
Yeah. And I mean, he's gone after McCain since McCain passed away. So,
well, no, I saw on your cartoon. Yeah. You were using garbage on his.
Right.
You know, it was great.
Right.
I mean, that set it off.
Well, it's, whether by design or just by how he is, he discovered. It's possible this could have happened before. He discovered that all these things are that supposedly everyone will automatically respond to as negative or bad. It's simply not true. And this may have increased because of the polarization of our media in particular, but he discovered that at least for a significant segment of people, they will forgive him anything as long as they continue to believe he's their champion somehow. And all the norms really weren't that solid, I don't think. I don't know, maybe Nick. I don't know if Nixon could have done this. Maybe.
I heard that with Nixon, Fox News was around when Nixon was president, he probably would have survived.
Oh, yeah, I think that's true. Yeah. Comparing then and now, the huge difference is that, we had three broadcast news stations. We had newspapers that were a dominant source of information, and pretty much everybody got their information from those places. So there wasn't any argument about reality. The argument was about policy and about, you know, what to do within the reality. Now you get a totally different version of the world if you watch Fox News as opposed to reading the New York Times. And I think that reinforces that human tendency to forgive your leader or your champion. If you never hear the negative, or if, as he's been very successful at doing, any negative news is fake, a lie, if you want to buy into that, then he's bulletproof.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I refer to when I talk to certain, you know, audiences and things about it, is I go back to like 2005, I think it was around that time, the University of Maryland did a poll of Americans in the country or whatever, and they asked seven questions, and the seven questions were like, it was right around after the invasion of Iraq, so it may have been 2003 or four, in there, and they asked seven questions, and they said, like, for example, was Saddam Hussein involved in plotting 9/11? Were there Iraqis on the planes?
Yeah.
Were there weapons of mass destruction found? Seven, all blatantly false.
Right.
Okay. And then the audience answered the question, and at the end of it, they would say, "Where's your primary news source?" If you answered six of those questions out of seven, saying they were all true, your primary news source was Fox.
Yeah.
And if they answered one and just saying only one of them were true, it was like CBS, ABC, NBC. That's when I realized this country's in real trouble.
Yeah.
Just what you alluded to, or actually said, is that we're in different planets. I mean, this are out and out lies that people believe. I was against the war since day one, or even before the lead up. Mm-hmm. However, if six out of those seven were true, I would have been for the war.
Yeah, yeah. But they weren't. But it didn't matter anymore. I mean, that has been the revelation in the last few years that I used to think that if you presented a sound argument and a series of facts to people, they'd say, oh, yeah, okay, I was wrong. That's true. And unfortunately, that is not the case. I mean, that a lot of people, and maybe more of us than we like to admit, are much more interested in accepting whatever reinforces our personal biases or our sense of the world, then we're more likely to just go with that than we are to, you know, bravely abandon an opinion because the facts prove it wrong. And it's made me question my job in some ways, or question how to do it, because even within the context of a political cartoon, I'm trying to make an argument based on what I think is sound reasoning or verifiable facts, but I realize it doesn't work, and especially with a cartoon, I think. So it's like, what is my job here? So now I just decided
to... So you're questioning that now you never have before?
Yeah, yeah. And then I decided, well, I'm not sure I ever swayed anybody anyhow. So I just have to do what I do. You know, I have this huge privilege of being able to put my view of the politics in the world out there, you know, three or four times a week and get paid to do it.
You're known mainly more as, you know, cartoonist, I guess, right. Political, but you also do a lot of writing along with your cartoons and things.
Yeah.
What's the difference in the process? I mean, your cartoons obviously get more play because you can look at it in 2 seconds, you know exactly what it is, and you're very talented at doing that. But then you accompany it at times with a column or something like that. Are you as proud of those, or how do you treat that differently, and how do you approach that?
Well, it's a good question. Because when at the PI, I was doing cartoons 4 and 5 times a week, and then would occasionally write something. But when I got to the LA Times, I ended up doing a column with every cartoon. So. In one sense, the process is the same. It all starts with there's something in the news to comment about, and so I try to gather as much information as I need to form what I hope is a smart opinion, and then decide what I want to say. But then there's a big difference between taking that with a column and with a cartoon. With a cartoon, there is this leap that is the most challenging thing of my job, where it's like, how do I say what I want to say in an image that people are going to understand? How do I whittle this down into the essence of what the issue is? And so that's always the stopping point. It's like, until I come up with that idea, I cannot go further. With a column, I found it actually much easier. It's like, I know what I want to say, I think of the first sentence, and it goes. And the more I did it, the better I was at that. Pairing them was, sometimes it felt like, well, I don't need to say it again. Sometimes I like the cartoon better than the column, sometimes the column better than the cartoon. But it was a way to take two approaches to it. One was the cartoon, sort of dynamic and simple. I always, I think the cartoons were often more opinionated than the columns were, because in the column I would sort of pull back and sort of be more analytical. But what I discovered was that people actually reacted more to the words than to the picture. I think I learned long ago that a political cartoon, even if someone disagrees with it, there's something sort of subversive about it. You know, people still like the drawing or kind of like the humor, or there's just a fun element that sets it apart. You can really be blatant in the opinion, but because it's a cartoon, people give you more latitude.
Say something. Is that because we're over comic books or something?
Yeah,
or it's
lighter
or something.
I know, it's just
like
a different, yeah. There's a different expectation. But I could write the same, you know, do the written version of whatever I said in the cartoon, and it would just really set people off. And that kind of surprised me, because I've always thought, well, cartoons are so, you know, hard-hitting and they're really edgy. But in terms of response from, you know, negative response from readers, it's the column that gets them.
I would have thought opposite.
Yeah, me too.
That's interesting.
But it was just, yeah. So since I've been at the Seattle Times, I haven't really written anything, mostly because I'm lazy. No, it's just that is not part of my deal here at this point.
Okay.
And I'm trying to provide more free time in my life, because it was crazy doing 3 columns and 3 cartoons a week for the LA
Times.
It was a lot.
And yeah, so that's a lot.
Wow, if I can just do cartoons for a while, I'll be fine. Yeah.
I want to talk to you about the fairness doctrine a little bit, just going along with that University of Maryland survey as to how we get to where we are now. And my feeling is that really the slow downhill march started with that elimination of that requiring networks to give balance. But of course, cable TV comes in, and I'm not sure they were required to adhere to that. But nonetheless, if they were, the FCC required that people give both sides of the issue.
Right.
And then as soon as they pulled that back, Rush Limbaugh started. And then, you know, all that started going. And now, of course, we have, what's his name, Alex Jones, just to the absolute over here. And I'm sure there's going to be somebody even worse than Alex Jones. That's the way it is. I feel a lot of the situation we're in now started with that. What do you think?
No, I think that's exactly right. And unfortunately, kind of only by a few years preceded the technological revolution of the internet. But yeah, I think that's what created Rush Limbaugh. Suddenly, because you didn't have to, you know, provide both sides or all sides, talk radio was born. And for whatever reason, it's worked a lot better for conservatives than for liberals. Rachel Maddow actually got her start on, what was it, Air America.
Al Franken was on.
Yeah, and Al Franken and Al Gore has tried that. Anyway, it just apparently liberals don't listen to the radio, or they already have NPR, or anyway, for whatever reason, that turned out to be a great vehicle for conservative opinion, and I hesitate to even talk about it as conservative opinion. It's really right-wing, crazy stuff. I really respect real people I consider real conservatives, like George Will and most of the, you know, David Froom and others, because they come from an intelligent set of arguments. But you know, Rush Limbaugh just blew it all open. It's like, we're going to have right-wing ideas and we're going to push our readers or our listeners to the extreme. We want to make them up. We make them mad. We want to stir it up, because that's what...
I almost think like Rush Limbaugh, you know, would have been a liberal if he could have made millions of dollars.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think he cares, because when he got in trouble, I watched him, he was on CBS Sunday Morning, and I thought they went really easy on him. I can't remember who was interviewing him, but it was like, I'm just an entertainer. People shouldn't believe me.
Yeah.
I'm just doing this. He falls back on that when he gets into trouble. And if I'm a person who's listening to him regularly, I'd be insulted by that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you know, these guys are buffoons is what he's saying. They're listening to what I'm saying. I'm just doing this for fun.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. And he has been reasonably open about his own view of himself as an entertainer first. And Hannity started in the same sort of way. But it worked so well. And then Fox News came along and sort of created another format for these opinions. And then we still might have been okay, but I think the internet just suddenly it created a huge megaphone for the craziest people in the country, and they could find each other. You know, I think they've always been there, but you know, all these, I imagine them, you know, these sort of oddballs in their basement in their underwear, you know, typing on keyboards, sending out horrible messages. But they used to all be alone, but now they're not mainstream, but they have become a big stream.
That's Seattle's editorial cartoonist and columnist, David Horsey. Now, as I said in my introduction, I have been a big fan of David Horsey's work for, 40 years now. And I suggest if you want to see some of his great work over the years, all you need to do is Google David Horsey, and that's H-O-R-S-E-Y. And if you do, you will have a very compelling walk through Northwest, American, and world history. That's all the time we have for this edition to Voices of Experience. My thanks to David Horsey for sharing his wisdom and experience with us today. Today is June 11th. I went back and did a little history checking. What happened today, at least in this country? In 1963, President Kennedy said in a speech that segregation is wrong and it's time to act. Days later, he sent civil rights legislation to Congress. In 1993, Jurassic Park opened up and set a weekend record of over $500 million in ticket sales. And I'll leave you today with this quote. I don't believe in a law from preventing a man from getting rich. It would do more harm than good. So while we do not propose any war upon capitalism, we do wish to allow the humblest man an equal chance to get rich with everyone else. Abraham Lincoln. Have a great rest of the week.